Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Now, Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Now, today's guest is a gent who, quite frankly, I'm sure everybody who will know who he is because he's got over 280,000, yes, 280,000 subscribers on YouTube, and he's amassed over 100 million views today. That's probably 999,000, however many more than me and Prust. But anyway, his real name is Andy. He lives in Great Mizzenden. Is that right? Great Mizzenden. And as well as being a diehard biker, he also flies a plane, like properly qualified pilot. That's why you'll know him as the Mizzenden Flyer. Is that right, Andy? Mizzenden?
Close enough. Mizzenden. There's an N you're missing there.
Mizzenden.
Yeah, we'll let you off.
I told you about my brain. It will catch me out. But yeah, the Mizzenden Flyer. It's a great nickname. That's a strong nickname, by the way.
Well, when I started this game, I thought, what the heck can I call myself? And because I didn't know I was necessarily going to just do motorcycles, because I was a big fan, obviously, my primary love is flying. Well, I say obviously, it was obvious to me at the time, is flying. And then I was motorcycling and skiing. They all were all things that were kind of had a bit of speed involved, you know, so flying along. And I had this image in my mind of like Victorian trains, you know, like the Flying Scotsman and stuff like that. I thought, I'll go with the Mizzenden Flyer and see how that works out. And then it didn't work out so well because I dropped the flying stuff and now it's just motorcycles. So, but it still sort of works, doesn't it?
I think it fits really well, Andy. And having been an avid watcher for a long time, just the other day watching you tinkering with your bike, fitting lights to your GS, just stuff like that I can watch and watch and watch. I just love it, the detail that you go into, the time that you take, and it's the respect that you give to the people that are watching that you really take your time. There's a real patience. You get really drawn in, Andy. I absolutely love it. But we're going to get onto that in due course. The stratospheric hits, the views, etc. But let's go back to where it all begins, because you talk about your love of flying and skiing. There's a bit of an adrenaline junkie in there, I can see. And the motorcycling, which is what we're all about on this podcast. Where does the love of motorbikes come from?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've always loved bikes ever since I can remember. And, when I was a lad, there were things called fizzies way before you were born, Dave. But you were
not me, though, Dave. I'm clearly ancient. Thanks, mate.
And basically, when you were 16, might have been 15, you're allowed to ride a 50cc moped, effectively they were, but they looked like motorcycles and they were super cool. So all my mates got them, but my mum and dad wouldn't let me have one because they saw them as dangerous beasts. So I lived in the fields in the wilds of Norfolk then. So of an evening in the summer, I used to bat around the fields on my mates' fizzies. So that's kind of where the love came from. And I also, obviously, as lads, you ride around on bikes. We used to back then, didn't you, in the good old days. So I was well into two wheels. But as I say, my mum and dad wouldn't let me have a bike. So then I became a student in London, and I managed to, at a car boot sale, buy another old moped, which I got running. It was non-runner, just did a bit of cleaning up. Managed to chuck it in the back of my old Ford Escort, got that running, and me and my student pals would ride that through the woods. That was great fun. Then I had a girlfriend who banned me from riding bikes. And
what?
Said, it's, I know. What sort of woman is that? She said, it's me or the bikes. So I said, oh, well, I was in love. So okay then. And then I married her. What an error. Yeah. So I got to like 30. I said, right, I'm 30 now. I'm going to get myself a motorcycle. And she was like, it's bikes or me. So again, I was only 10 years in. I thought, oh, okay, then you can stick around. Anyway, move on another 10 years. 40 now. And I said, look, I'm a proper grown up. I'm going to get myself a motorcycle. She said, it's me or a bike. I said, well, off then. You can. So anyway, she's still with me 17 years later. And she now rides bikes herself. What's all that about?
That's one
after all.
That's Andy, I reckon you're the first guest out of all the series we've done where you've had to rebel to get it. Most people say, oh yeah, my uncle's into bikes and my dad's a diehard biker. It's in the blood. But it's really interesting to see that you were dying to be a biker and the missus and was putting a foot down and no. But how things have changed. I mean, in terms of that was a hobby you secretly did and now it's a way of life for you. I mean, did you ever envisage or dream that biking would be your job? Because I mean, obviously the way people watch TV and everything has changed nowadays and YouTube is so huge. Did you ever dream though that this could be a career for you?
Well, no, of course not. I mean, it's I pinch myself every day how lucky or fortunate I've been. I prefer fortunate to lucky, to be honest. To have ended up here, because this whole YouTube thing was just a hobby that came good. I was as well as being a keen or lover of motorbikes and anything that moved under its own steam, really. I was also a keen photographer. So come about 2008, I think it was. That was when these things called GoPros came out, and we hadn't seen them before. And I thought, actually, you know what? I'm doing these activities that I would quite like to film for my mum and dad and friends to see. And there's this thing now that's been around for a couple of years called YouTube. Maybe I should get one of these cameras, learn how to do video editing, because I was only taking still photographs at that time. And it kind of combined. And also, I was, this is the slightly sad bit, I was a bit of a computer nerd. So it's one of those confluence of all those things that, and my degree was in computing and I was working in computing. So it was a confluence of all the things I liked and could do. So action type things, photography, learning video and the computer side, plus YouTube, plus I was a bit of a show off generally. I was kind of a failed radio presenter. So it all came together and I thought, you know what, this is exactly for me. So it seemed very easy to me because all the elements you need to do YouTube, I was doing for fun anyway. So it started as a hobby. I uploaded a few skiing videos and a few flying videos. Now I never watch those, but I did a bike one and loads of people started commenting and writing back to me. So, you know, I thought I'll ditch the flying and the skiing and I'll just do the biking. And then, you know, that was 2008, I think, when I uploaded my first video, which was, I think, YouTube itself only started in 2006. So in that respect, I was very lucky. So although those numbers you read out earlier sound quite impressive in isolation, it's taken me flipping years to get here. But I only really started doing it seriously on the bikes in 2014. And then I ditched my real job in 2017. So I've been doing it as a serious pursuit for, 8 years now. So yeah, it's not been an overnight thing.
The obvious work that goes into it, because as you well know, and you can see anything on YouTube from stuff that's very, very roughly cut and thrown together to something that's really professionally done in your sense. And I'm not saying professional in the sense of something that's not engaging, because sometimes things can look too slick, can't they? And the real kind of love of what YouTube is that reality, that kind of that thing that draws you into something that's really quite engaging, which is absolutely your USP.
Well, I'm glad you think that, because I purposely, when I thought, well, let's try and make this a thing, there are a few sort of strategic decisions I made. One was, which I regret, I'll have some catchphrases, because people love a catchphrase. Turns out they don't, particularly not mine. Another thing was, I'll never swear on stuff. I want to keep it family friendly. I mean, I do swear in real life, but I try not to on YouTube. I might have broken that rule once or twice. And then the other thing was, I'm not going to make it look too slick. Now, I know, you know, high production value is a great thing, but you can start to blur the lines between what's a professionally produced video, as you say. I mean, you watch some YouTubers and they're equally as good, sometimes better than what you see on TV in terms of production. And I purposely wanted to keep mine sort of man in the street, just the same as, you know, anybody else in the garage. So that's my excuse for having rubbish production values anyway.
That's the key thing, because when you are doing either a review of a bike or the functional element, I told you about looking at little things like installing bikes, which you'll have hopefully people listening to this that are very much in our wheelhouse of what bikes mean to us. We've all been there on our hands and knees in the garage cursing this machine because it's not good. And my first port of call when I'm doing things like tinkering and farkling is, there must be someone on YouTube that knows exactly how to do this. So you type in the Missenden Fly and then suddenly there's a huge backdrop of different videos and you'll have a little flick through and it's there. And it's TV at your own pace, isn't it? You can stop it. You can go back. You can listen to it again. You can blow it up. And that's what I've loved about yours, Andy, in the sense of when it comes, and we'll mention it in a second about reviewing bikes, and to stay true to what you want to do and to come away from what your job was to what your profession is now, you had to be honest, you had to stick to your guns, and you have to be yourself. And that's what absolutely shines through on the channel.
Well, I'm glad you think that, Dave. That's very kind of you to say so. I mean, I try to... As soon as you try and pretend to be something you're not, you're dead in the water, aren't you? So yeah, authenticity is key. And that can sometimes be a bit of a problem, because if you have a bike that you genuinely don't like, the current BMW GSA is one that's high in my mind, then, you know, I can't lie and say I find it a really attractive looking bike. The thing's horrible, isn't it? But people do like them. They sell a lot and I'm sure it rides beautifully, but I won't be caught dead on one in my garage. And that's going to get me a load of hate stuff now. But anyway, the point is, you've got to say that, haven't you? If you, I mean, a classic one was, I a couple of years ago, I rode a Norton the Commando, and I was desperate to ride it. I really was looking forward to it.
And it looks amazing.
And I love the British bikes and the history around Norton and everything else. And I love the new bikes they've just brought out at Icoma, but that's another story. But that 961 under the old Ghana regime, mm-hmm. I wanted to ride that. I got one, and my goodness me, what an absolute dog it was of a bike. Yeah. I was so disappointed. So I had to say it. And it was, and pointing out those things that made it a dog of a bike, the fact that it had indicators that looked like they're off a cheap Chinese machine. The paint quality was poor. It was a really, there was just things about it that I could show on camera weren't good. I was as disappointed as the next person, but at least I was being truthful about it. I mean, there are plenty of videos that said it was a great bike and it plainly wasn't.
I think that's really important. Like Pratt said, and you mentioned the word authenticity. If you're not true, then people will see through that. And I think it's really important. Like you said, you don't need to be slick and totally edited, because that means you're different to everyone else. You want to be like the man next door, the girl next door who likes to tinker with the bikes. But I was going to ask you, actually, going back to that point you said, when you ride a Norton or you ride a well-known bike and it isn't as good, it hasn't lived up to your expectations, is it hard for you? Obviously, it's not. You have to be honest. But do you sort of give the press bike back sometimes and go, oh, thank you, but don't watch my YouTube channel? I mean, what is it like? You don't want to burn any bridges, but yet to your viewers, you need to be real.
I'm very fortunate because I'm at that position now. I mean, although in terms of YouTube numbers, my YouTube channel isn't that big. In terms of UK motorcycle YouTubers, I'm in the top five. So I have motorcycle manufacturers, you know, falling over themselves to lend me their bikes. So there's no shortage of bikes. There's far more than I can possibly review. So in a way, I'm in that lucky position where they need me almost more than I need them now. So I don't have that issue anymore. When you start off, and of course, I watch new YouTubers that come along, and you can sense that they're doing that fine balancing act. So that, you know, you don't want to burn your bridges, do you? But you do have to be honest. So, you know, if you can demonstrate what you're saying is true, then I don't think a manufacturer's got a problem. And in fact, as much as I joke about the BMW GSA, I mean, I'm sure it rides absolutely fantastically. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of personal taste, whether you like the look of it or not. And that's fair enough. Everybody's got their own taste, haven't they? I have to say BMW have been great about it. They lent me a GS for 6 months. I did nothing but slag it off. It's still sold in its drove. So my videos had no impact whatsoever. And they're perfectly fine about it. And no manufacturer has ever said to me, don't say this, you've got to say that. So you know, credit to them, really.
And I think from your point of view as well, especially when you're talking about the Norton just then, which is a beautiful machine, the GSA, I absolutely get where you're going with that, Andy, because if you look at that progression, I mean, you can go a very long way back to where GS is started, but the classic one of being an 1150, which obviously the long way around bikes look amazing, and they have aged beautifully. They look like works of art in a tractor type sense, but yes. The new one that comes along, and you look at it, and it's something from the future, which 15 years time, they might go, well, yeah, that's obviously the way they were going to go. But I absolutely am with you there. And what comes across, going back to the authenticity point of view, is there might be people on YouTube that review it in a certain way for likes and clicks. You're doing it because you want to see what it's like. And your disappointment is tangible and real, because you're going, oh, no, I want to love the Norton Commando, but
correct,
this, that, and that make it something that I can't love. And you've got to be able to purvey that.
That's right. And that was definitely the case with the GS, because I pretty much built my channel on the back of the BMW GS. I had an R1200 for over, I think, 12, 13 years.
Fantastic bike.
I've got a 1250 now because I didn't want to buy the 1300 for all the reasons I'd said in my videos. So I am a GS fan. So yeah, I was really disappointed when that bike was unveiled and it turned out it wasn't quite as good as I was waiting for it for ages. That was going to be my next bike as far as I was concerned. So there we go. Anyway,
can I ask you, I actually want to slightly go back, if I can, ask you about the flying, because like it's really rare. I think it's very rare to speak to someone who makes a living out of motorbikes, but also can put his hand to fly a plane if he wants. I mean, we've had Steve Parrish on, you've had people on who do fly as well. But I mean,
yeah, Steve's got his own strip and he said I can land in it.
Yeah, well, there you go. Take him up on that. I mean, how did all that come about? Was that because you said you're a keen photographer as well? I mean, you seem like you do a lot of things very well.
Yeah, I just like hobbies. That's the end of them. You don't want to go down some of them, I'll tell you. So the flying thing was kind of my first love. I've always liked aeroplanes when I was a kid. I used to go to air shows a lot, still do, in fact. And when I started to make a bit of money for myself, I thought something I'd really like to do is learn to fly, which I did when I was about, I don't know, 30, 1997, I got my license. So I've actually been flying far longer than I've been motorcycling. And I think I'm a better pilot than I am motorcyclist. But the two things, you say you don't know many people that can fly and ride bikes. It's odd because if you go to any flying club and I go on my bike and I park up,
they all ride bikes.
No, yeah, and it turns out they're all bike riders.
It's a bit like the Top Gun kind of thrill seekers, I suppose. But okay, well, we'll put it this way. Me and Prats ride bikes, but I would not trust me near an aeroplane.
So I think there's a lot of pilots who are bikers, maybe not so many bikers that are pilots.
It must be a lovely skill set to have down the pub, just to say, oh, by the way, I can fly planes as well. I mean, it's mega.
The thing is, the two of them, and indeed my other main hobby, which is skiing, all share some of the same things. So with the biking and the flying, I mean, I physically love the machines. I appreciate the engineering in them, the history around them, all that stuff. There's skill involved in mastering them. Mm-hmm. And you can argue whether there's more skill in flying or biking. I don't think they're one's harder than the other. One's a bit more hassle to do, for sure. But I mean, it's not actually that much harder than riding a bike, flying a plane. In fact, I don't think it's hard at all. There's a certain danger element. There's a certain being at one with the elements. You're very aware of the environment around you. If you're flying a light plane, you can feel the wind moving the thing around. You can feel the wind on the controls. So, you know, there's a lot of the same stuff, the joy of the machine, the skill involved and all that stuff. So I think if you like riding a bike, you'd probably like flying a plane.
You've just jogged my memory there. Would it have been Steve that told us that he was explaining such a fantastic way of judging, as you say, Andy, the perception of danger for motorcycling and flying a plane? I think, was it his take on it, Ewan, where he said, well, obviously riding a bike's more dangerous because you're on a road with other people. In theory, in a plane, you'll do well to be flying very, very close to other objects, wouldn't you? You've got quite a bit of the sky to yourself, whereas on a road, you've got people not happy with bikes, not letting bikes in, pulling out on bikes.
Very true. Although the statistics are interesting. I actually made a video on this years ago. They measure danger in something called a micromort. And I can't remember the exact number of micromorts per activity. Mm. It turned out flying light aircraft and riding a motorcycle were about the same danger level, which I thought was quite interesting. Didn't tell my wife because she was quite happy for me to fly and not too happy about the bikes at that stage. But the thing that was even more dangerous was riding a horse. Now, how many people send their 12-year-old daughter off to ride a horse? And I thought, well, there you go. That's interesting, isn't it?
I suppose the thing is with a horse, you're not in total control. It's an animal, and animals can flip, can't they? But I would have thought if it goes badly wrong on a bike, it's pretty bad. If it goes badly wrong in an aeroplane, it's really bad, unless you've got a parachute. So, yeah, I don't, what, you seem to speak very obviously with love about what you do, but hat off to you, because seriously, for you to say, I fly a plane, I can do this, you're obviously a very skilled man.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. Trust me, I know some pretty daft pilots. it's like any of these skills you learn, you gradually build it up, don't you? And when the first time I went in a light aeroplane, I was, I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. There's just too much going on. The radio navigation, this is in the days before GPS as well. So not only did you have to fly the thing, you had to look at a map and work out where you were. And that really added to the stress, I can tell you. So, you build it up over time and it just becomes natural. And I find riding a bike or flying a plane about the same. As I say, when I jump in the plane, it's like putting on an old pair of slippers and off you go. Whereas people who've never been in the plane before, they're always absolutely amazed by what's going on. Yeah. I remember last year, I in return for making a video, do you know Alan Milliard, the genius engineer? I went on the back of his bike called the Flying Milliard, which he made out of an aeroplane engine. And I said to him, well, why don't we film the video at the local airfield? And in return for me going on the back of your bike, I'll take you up in the plane, which he was well up for. And when we were in the plane, he was just agog at what was going on. I was thinking, well, how can you be impressed? You're this genius engineer and you're impressed by me just taking off, doing a few circuits and tipping me wings about. So it's great. It's great that people do love it. Mm. But yeah, I ask any pilot that does it regularly. It's not, it's nothing special, but I appreciate, again, it's a privilege to be able to do it.
Well, it's a wonderful matter of fact. It's like James Whittam as well. Another one that we've had on that combines the two. I just find it fascinating, and it's that command of what these wonderful things are. Let's chuck it back to the two-wheel variety, which is a little less, panic-inducing than the feels potentially to fly a plane. You mentioned about your career, if you like, of riding and getting to ride a bike and starting young. And does that mean, wherein lies the official passing of the test then in all that, given what you said about not being allowed it and then potentially not being allowed, then moving on. Were you an older?
Yes, absolutely. People assume that I've been riding for donkey's years and know what I'm talking about. All untrue. I think I passed my test in 2011. Wow. So not that long in the scheme of things. You know, I get people, I go to bike meets and stuff, and people come up and show me their bike that they've brought. And if it's before 2012, I have no clue what the hell it is. So they'll talk to me about this slab side kettle or something, and I'm sort of nodding as if I know what they're talking about. I haven't got a freaking clue. So yeah, that can be quite embarrassing actually, because people do just assume that you know more about it than you do. So I do try and build a persona on my channel, a bit of me being a bit of an idiot when it comes to knowing what I'm doing. And that way, if you do know something, you're always going to surprise people, aren't you? So I never claim to be an expert on anything in my videos. I even put a little disclaimer up that lasts about a quarter of a second at all my videos. If you can actually pause it, it explains exactly why I'm just an idiot and I don't know what I'm doing and all that stuff. The reason why I put that there actually is because I get a lot of the same, I get one or two hate comments as you do when you're in this game, and they're usually the same thing. So in that little split second, I put all the answers to those hate comments, and it just amuses me when I say to a troll, just pause the small print.
They're like, I'm looking for it.
And then they have to be really hard to do it. So
love that.
Bearing in mind, you pass your test later than a lot of us. What was that feeling like? I'm assuming it was just as enthusiastic to hear those words, congratulations, you've passed the test. Because I know for me, it was just literally, because I was younger, it was all of a sudden, wow, freedom. I can do what I want now. I can go somewhere. What joy did it bring to you when you passed your test?
Oh, fabulous joy, because again, it was something I'd wanted to do ever since the year dot. To actually be allowed to do it was a big thing. And then I didn't pass first time either, so it took a bit of effort. And in fact, I think the getting the bike license was tougher than passing my flying test.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it didn't help that I learnt in winter, and of course, being an older person, I did one of those DAS schemes, so you do it in a fairly short order. And I didn't have access to a motorbike myself, so all my riding was done when I was with an instructor. So I had no practice or
That's
anything.
Really? Tough,
I did. Yeah. I remember I did the test, the what was called the Mod 2, I think it's still the same, which is effectively like your driving test out on the road in Uxbridge, where I'd never ridden before. And it was a frosty, icy day in the morning, so I didn't know if the test was going to go ahead. And by the time I went to do the test, it was raining. And as a glasses wearer, and at that time I didn't know about pin locks, so I had to have my visor open. Rain was going in on the glasses, and I got to a mini roundabout in Pinewood or somewhere, just didn't see the roundabout, went straight over it. So surprise, I failed. So that was I felt absolutely gutted as a result of that, and it was a silly mistake because everything else seemed to go okay. So so I was doubly joyed when I got all the stuff done, because there's quite a lot involved in passing your bike test these days, aren't there? No wonder youngsters aren't doing it.
I remember I failed first time around. I did my emergency stop and I skidded on some leaves, and I was gutted when I'd failed. And I came back as soon as I could retake it, and it was the same instructor, and he was just, I knew I was going to pass, because he said, oh, lovely to see you again. Just relax, enjoy today. And I just thought, I'm going to pass it.
Good man.
Nice to hear those words, you've passed. It was like, yes.
There's some diamonds out there, aren't there?
Yeah. He was a good man. He was, yeah.
That's a bit about being encouraged to do it. You make a bit of a decent point there, Andy, because it is, there is, you totally understand about making something such as this and achieving something such as this. You've got to cover so many bases to make sure that you put people on the road, hopefully, that are fit for purpose and also going to be a positive with the road-going community. But there is an element where I'm like you, and I passed my test nearly 20-odd years ago, and I had a neighbour of mine that was going through it, similar age to me, so mid-40s now, so that was kind of just off the back of COVID. So older, not a 17-year-old tear-arsing around trying to get his licence as soon as possible, but he said it takes a lot of brain power, you've got to work through the modules, got to get to the next bit, and you kind of, there is the cynical part of you, which I think kind of hinting at a little bit, Andy, is that, is this done to make people better riders, or for people, or to push people away from it slightly to go, do you know what? I can't be asked to go through all that because there's so many hoops to jump through to get actually out on a bike on your own.
I think that's the reality of it. It does have that effect, doesn't it? Mm. But actually, when you look back at when, like in the 70s and 80s, my cousins had bikes and I was very jealous of them because they were similar ages to me. And in those days, though, people were coming off all the time and having terrible injuries. In fact, one of my cousins, he had a Honda Super Dream. I remember it's the first bike I ever went on the back on a 250. I thought it was massive. Anyway, a few weeks after he took me on the back, he had a nasty accident, lost a bit of his leg, and his life has been ruined as a result of it. He's never worked. And, you know, those sort of stories happened an awful lot. And you don't actually hear that so much now.
No, probably, correct.
Yeah. Bikers, because none of us could pass the test. Yeah. But I do think it has been, in the main, a good thing. It's made it a safe pastime, but perhaps it's gone a bit too far and needs to ease back a bit, particularly for the youngsters. You know, when, again, I'm not an expert on what the test regime is now, but this thing where you have to do the two tests when you're like 18 and then a couple of years later you have to do them again. I mean, that just makes no sense, does it?
When I did it back in the day, I think I've passed in 1991, and it was like literally on a 125, and then you pass your test, and that afternoon you can go and buy a 1000cc if you want. And I think the danger there was, in fact, someone in my school did do that and unfortunately lost his life, because you're all of a sudden going from a relatively unpowered machine to an absolute beast. And you know, if you had the money to pay for the insurance, you could do what you want. So I'm sure they do it for the right reasons now, but I'm actually quite pleased when I passed. It's like, yeah, it's a free card now. Once you pass, you can get whatever you like, although it's dangerous, but yeah, it was good.
I need to ask you guys a question. I'm sorry to do this to you, but I did a bit of Wikipedia-ing, as you do. I couldn't find out, David, what you're riding.
I'm currently on I've fallen in love with it. It's been a long-going love affair. It's about 8 years in now. It's a Triumph Bonneville Bobber Black, which has got so many odds and ends put on it. It's quite... different to the bike that I picked up a very long time ago. It's actually going in for a service tomorrow.
Good luck.
The very lovely people at Triumph West Yorkshire, who I know a couple of that I have a chat with, and they're coming to pick it up and take it in. But there is an element where I'm thinking they're going to be looking at it going, what the hell have you done to this? There's lights on it that weren't there before. There's different mirrors on it. It's a bit noisier. But I love it, Andy.
It looks good, Dave. When I saw your bike props, I loved
it.
It's personalised. It's you. And you use it. Let's be honest, he's a proper biker, Andy. Correct. He uses that, whatever the weather. So,
Andy, ask Ewan about his. Come on.
I'll get there, because I sent some harliness. But... So if you've had that for 8 years, that must have been when the Bobber first came out, must it, around about?
So yeah, Andy, but I mean, basically it's the first iteration of what the Bobber Black was, which was a slightly meatier version of the Bobber, bigger front wheel. It had a tiny little tank on, which meant you could do about 90 miles, and then the range light came on. Truth be told, in all of my research, that was a glaring omission from it, which I was looking around thinking, this thing's either leaking or it's got the smallest tank, really small tank. So I swapped that out for the one at the time, which was on the Speedmaster, which now comes as standard, which means I can get, I don't know, nicely ridden 150 miles out of it, which helps for my touring when I go abroad, but also helps my backside. Because if you look at the seat on that, it's nice to a degree, but I got a slightly bigger one, slightly bigger backside and slightly bigger seat, Andy. So they fit nicely together. So it fitted, and it's far culled to where it needs to be. Suits me down to the ground. Very comfortable. I can get where I need to go. Love it.
They're cool looking bikes, aren't they? They are cool. And I was thinking, as you talked about the small tank there, actually, how much range do you want on one of them? Because I find they get me back in a bit. I'm a fan of the Speedmaster. They bought a new one out now.
It's like an armchair, that one. It looks beautiful. Before you ask Ewan about his wonderful concoction, and it's a glorious thing. I mean, going back to what you said before about reviewing bikes, and it's something that you and I mentioned many, many, many times about how our envy of Triumph saying to our lovely guests, why don't you just take that one? Which must be, again, music to your ears as a bike fanatic.
It's fantastic. And I'm a Triumph fanboy as well. So I pretty much like everything in their range, actually. And they've definitely got that sort of retro.
Yes, nailed it, haven't they? Very much so.
And the new, now they've revamped them all. I think there's something like 29 new models in 2026. It's crazy. They're busy at Hinkley, aren't they?
Yes, good for the industry as well, going in that direction.
Exactly right. Anyway, to the elephant in the room. Ewan, tell us about your bike. And how often do you ride?
I don't ride enough. I should do more. It's very uncomfortable, but it looks so
amazing.
Cool. So I've got Harley Crossbones, which they don't make anymore. And basically when I got it, it looks good. It's a big old Harley. It just looked a bit standard to me. So I went to King's Road, to Wars, and I said, here's my bike, blank canvas, do what you want. And there's a guy there called Charlie Stockwell who works magic. And basically, I think the only thing literally standard on my bike now is the frame. So imagine like a bit of a chopped up bobber bike. Gold bits everywhere, blingy, but yet not over the top. It's cool, isn't it, Prats? It does look very, very nice. In fact, it looks very nice in my front room. I'm looking at it right now. So that will tell you how often I ride it.
Yeah. Front room, maybe not the best place to ride, but it sounds fantastic. And isn't Wars, am I right in thinking that that's like the oldest Harley dealer in the country?
They've been around literally forever. So they did loads of work on it. I took it to a place down in Southampton called Attitude, which is great, really good bike builder there called Carter, who did a bit more magic on the magic. And I just look at it, but I'm gonna get it back out and start using it. I had a bit of an awkward moment with my son, who I was taking to the gym. And without putting a morbid turn onto this podcast, yeah. I said, look, in the gym, there's a guy there with one leg, my mate Scott. And he said, oh, how come he's got one leg, Daddy? I said, well, listen, first of all, when you meet him, ask him any questions you want, but do not stare because that's rude. He said, of course I wouldn't stare, Dad. Why only one leg? And I said, oh, he had a really bad motorbike accident. And my son said, Daddy, I don't want you ever riding a bike again. And I was like, oh, and literally the next day I sold my enduro bike and I couldn't sell the Harley, and I need to, he's a bit older now, so I think he might understand, but I'm going to get back on it.
That's tough. That's a tough
it's
one.
It's a
isn't
tough
it?
One. Yeah.
Out the mouth of babes.
I mean, I often wonder if my kids said to me, Dad, I'm going to get a bike, how I'd feel about that. I mean, they're not kids anymore, they're adults, but I think I'd be hypocritical of me to say you can't have one in any way. It's up to them what they do. They're adults, as I say. But I think as long as you've driven a car for a bit and have got some road sense, then you're probably all right.
Yeah, as we all know, it's not you necessarily on the bike, is it? It's the idiots who don't see you, you know. So that's my excuse for having really loud pipes as well. But, but it is true. I think one of the best bits of advice I got when I started riding bigger bikes, someone just said, imagine you are invisible and you'll be all right. Mm. No one's going to see you. Everyone's going to pull out when you least expect it. So always expect something. And that's how I kind of ride. But, you know, we just hope, stay safe, you know.
I had the same advice, and I do that. And the other one that I think my instructor told me, which I think is actually very true, he said, if you ride your bike like you drive a car, you'll never have a problem. It's because I think there's a bit of a thing about when you get on a bike. I mean, I'm a fairly measured, calm, controlled character. If I get on my Ducati, I've got the Street Fighter V4S, 208 brake horsepower. I can't help it. Yeah. There's no pollution. You ride like an idiot because that's the sort of bike it is. And it's very, very, you've got to have amazing self-control, haven't you? To ride my Street Fighter the same way as I drive my daughter's Ford Fiesta. Very difficult indeed.
Yeah, you're right. And to be fair, that does make you think. I'll be thinking about that the next time I'm out on my bike. Let's have a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping, folks. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Right, Andy, you've already mentioned some amazing bikes. God, make me even more envious. What is your current stock of bikes looking like? Or do you not have that many because you get to borrow any bike you want? I mean, what are you riding?
Well, that's a very interesting point, actually, because I'll come on to that in a minute. So at the moment, this year I've tried to trim my fleet slightly. So at the moment, I've got 7 bikes in the garage.
Oh, trimmed it to 7.
Let me finish. 2 of which are loan bikes, okay? One of which is my wife's bike. So I personally have only got 5.
Oh, poor you.
No, I'm not expecting any violins here. So I've got a custom Royal Enfield Interceptor.
Nice. Which
I've just got that finished off to exactly as I want it. It looks like a proper motorbike should look. Hmm. It's in green and gold with gold wheels. It's blingy. Not very powerful, but it sounds epic. And round the lanes on a summer's Sunday, perfect. So I love that. I've got a Kawasaki Z900 RS, which is the retro bike. There's a theme here. I like retros. Yeah. The thing is with the Z900 RS, it's based on the Z900. So it's very much a modern 4-cylinder bike underneath. So with some extra header pipes on it, you'll appreciate this, Ewan. It sounds absolutely amazing. In fact, it sounds like a Formula One car when you want it. So that's got the looks and the performance. My practical bike is I've got the GS, the 1250, which, you know, if the house is up in flames, that's the one I'd rescue because it does everything really well. I've got the Ducati that I mentioned, the Street Fighter V4S, which is relatively new to me. So I'm still in the love affair, novelty factor, still doing some work on that. What have I missed? I've missed something. I'm just sort of walking through my garage now. And something else, but I can't remember what it is.
What a position that is in to be. There's another motorbike kicking around. Yeah. I can't quite tell you what it is.
The second part of it, you said about, or don't you have any? Because there are a lot of, I speak to journalists and stuff occasionally, a lot of them don't actually own their own bikes because they do borrow them all the time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know what, certainly it would make financial sense, wouldn't it? Because I could certainly have several bikes all the time if I wanted to. But I've got a bit of a thing about owning bikes and I just love the ownership experience. So I used to have, for example, a Panigale, the original, or the 899, but it was a beautiful looking bike.
Nice, yeah.
Complete garage queen. I just love the fact when I opened the garage door, it was there. I thought, wow, what an amazing bike. Then I'd jump on the GS. But I just enjoyed having the thing there, you know. So you know, there's this thing now called PCP where you can do these loans effectively, or in fact, you rent the bike, don't you? And at the end of it, you give it back, or a balloon pack. I just can't be doing it. I know it works for lots of people, but for me, I want to say that that's my bike and I own it. And I do want to bolt on some lights and farkle it to death and make it my own. So none of my bikes are standard. They've all got, you know, stuff on that make people feel ill when they see them, because I've got a thing about lights. So or GS, for example. It's like a flipping Christmas tree.
Looks amazing, by the way. It looks amazing.
I'm loving it. So I can't remember where we were going with that. But
do you know where I'll go with that? And I think Prats will agree. I think it's really, really a lovely point you make, the fact that isn't it nice to own things that you've worked hard for? Mm-hmm. And if you're having a bit of a rainy day or you're too wet to go on the bike, you just go and sit in the garage for a minute and just joy at what you have and look at them and think, wow, that's... Because I'm like that with toys. You know, I'm like that with toys. I've got an old truck, which I've spent far too much doing. I hardly use it. But I go in the garage and just look at it. And it's just like, it's just nice to be in a position in life where you've worked hard. And especially for you and the wife for so many years said you're not having a bike. Too right, you should have seven in the garage because, you know, you're allowed them.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll tell her that you said that.
Tell her you need eight. You need another one. Yeah.
Well, the trouble is, a bit like you and your Harley, I don't get to ride them enough because I'm riding other people's all the time. I get criticised because people will go onto the internet and see what my bike's MOT status is and then work out how many miles I've ridden in the year. And then they'll say, oh, you've got that Enfield, you've only done 300 miles. Well, that might be true. But I've probably done 40,000 miles in total because I've been touring somewhere on somebody else's bike. But yeah, the thing is, when I do get to ride my bikes, I realise they're the ones that I really want to ride. So to answer the previous question about not having them, just borrowing them, I don't think I'll ever do that because the ownership experience is, for me, a big part of the whole thing.
I love the phrase as well, Garage Queen, which ironically is mine and Dave's nickname for Ewan. in all of that then, Andy, could you tell us if there is a favourite? I get the feeling that there's an answer which I might have the letters G and S in.
Whatever I'm riding at that moment. Yeah. I'm in the very fortunate position. Those bikes that I've got, over the years, you kind of work out what sort of riding you want to do, don't you? When you first start, you don't necessarily know what sort of a biker you're going to be. I love the looks of sports bikes, but I didn't realize quite how uncomfortable they were. Stuff like that. So I'm chuffed now because I look in my garage and I think, what bike would I like to replace any of these with? And I can't think of what I'd rather have than the bikes I've got. And I've never been in that position in the 15 years, whatever it is, since I passed my license. So I'm just absolutely chuffed. I've got my dream bikes. I don't really have a favorite. It depends whatever... Because they're all for different purposes, a bit like handbags and shoes, isn't it? Apparently, so I'm told. You know, you can't have too many. And, you know, if you want to potter around on a Sunday afternoon, then that's the Royal Enfield custom bike.
Yeah.
If I want to do a long tour, then I'm on the GS with the wife on the back. If I want to scare myself, then I'm on the Ducati, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. If I want to spend Spain in winter, then the Kawasaki goes and I can rag around those amazing Spanish roads in the winter and really enjoy myself. So I love all those. I think it would be great to just have two bikes because then you'd ride them more.
Yeah.
But I just cannot bring myself to lose any of those bikes I've got.
Don't blame me, mate.
It's lovely how content you are with your collection. Because I was going to ask you, is there a bike that's evaded you? What is that scratch you need to itch? But it sounds like you've ridden all the bikes there are, and out of everything you've ridden, you've got your dream collection.
Well, again, what a fortunate position in that I have pretty much ridden all the bikes that I'd want to ride, and a few I didn't want to as well. I was lucky enough a few years ago, I rode a Honda Goldwing. Now, I know they've got all sorts of connotations. They're almost as bad as Harleys, for goodness sake.
Easy.
But I tell you, I first rode, it was the new one. It was 2018 when it was revamped. Mm. And I rode that. I thought, my goodness me, I think it was 34 grand, the bike. I thought, there's no way I can ever have a bike like this. This is just too much for a bike. Anyway, long story short, I ended up owning two of those Goldwings and they were fantastic bikes. But one trick ponies, I ended up selling my Goldwing last year. And I don't now miss it because it was too big, too heavy and all that. It was fantastic for the purpose for which it was built. Long tours with the missus on the back. Brilliant. But I did, you know, that itch got scratched. So that was the sort of dream bike I thought I'd never get. But I suppose it's the same with the Panigale I had as well. There's nothing really. I mean, obviously I've been watching the coverage from EICMA and I do like the look of those new Nortons. They look amazing, Beautiful. Particularly the sport bike and indeed the adventure bike. I really like the look of that MV Agusta Brutale. Have you seen the, it's called the Series something or other.
It's gorgeous. It's
But they don't make an ugly bike, do they? The exhaust systems on intricacy, they're beautiful.
I noticed there's no price though for that one. So I got a feeling that's going to be Goldwing Plus. But I wouldn't mind a little tickle on one of those, I must admit. But yeah, otherwise I'm very happy with the bikes I've got. I just need to, like you, I need to ride them more. Find it's keeping some weather. To get out on them.
Well, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? I mean, we're all pretty much hunkered in now till spring. So that's from a biking point of view, itches to scratch. What's the rest of the year, maybe into next year, looking like? Because you are super consistent with your delivery of content. I presume that's a massive part of where success comes from. Yes, it's got to be good and watchable, but you've got to feed the frenzy, really, haven't you? So how far do you plan? What have you got planned, Andy?
Well, I... I plan, this is very sad again, this is the sort of person I am. I have a spreadsheet, as you can imagine, and I've actually got videos planned 2 a week for the next year. I know exactly what I'm going to record.
Wow.
But there's flexibility built in, because of course new bikes will come out, opportunities will present themselves. So I'll keep it very flexible. Mm. But I like to know what's coming down the line. So normally in the past, I'd have lots of tours and stuff. I've been lucky to ride all over the world. I did a great trip to Japan. I did the Arctic Circle and I've done Alaska and all that. But the last year, I've had real issues with my shoulder. I'm waiting for my shoulder to be replaced. Okay. So that has rather stymied number one off-roading and also long tours. So I have got some tours planned, but I've got a feeling they're going to probably go by the wayside. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I'll have it done in time for next summer that I can do a planned trip in Germany. Which I'm really looking forward to. But yeah, so otherwise I haven't really got any tours planned. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask me where would I like to go, having, you know, I've been lucky in that I've ridden all around the world. The place I haven't ridden, where I'd love to go, is New Zealand. I think that would be just a fantastic place to ride. And again, maybe on a Goldwing or something. They've got big wide roads there, haven't they? I mean, touring on one of those in New Zealand would be just amazing. Or my GS.
You and Ewan, go on then, Ewan. So your last question, Ewan.
I was about to go into our last question, which I think, Andy, you've probably answered it, but you can go into more detail. We'd love to ask our guests about their hypothetical fantasy ride. So if you could ride anywhere in the world, what road would it be on? What country would you be on? What bike would you ride? Who would you be with, and would you be listening to a soundtrack? So it is probably New Zealand. I don't know. But so where are you going? Who with? What bike and any music?
Yeah, New Zealand, and it would be either a GS or a Goldwing, because it's touring bikes. Mm. I've not found anything better. In terms of who would I be with? Well, I've got to say my wife, the ex-biker, the one that didn't want to get into biking, who now loves it. Because one of the things I found about biking, when you go to these amazing places, like, for example, I'm guessing New Zealand, if you did it there, you have such great experiences on the bike, don't you? And it's so much better if you can share it with somebody. Yes. So, I bullied my wife to give up work because I'd done a tour. I went to the Arctic Circle in Norway on my GS. It was such a good trip. And I came back full of all these experiences that she didn't share with me. So I said, you've got to leave work so we can do these together. And then she came to Alaska with me. So, and it was fantastic.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, yes, it would be. So the missus in New Zealand, soundtrack would be the soundtrack of the bike. I'm afraid.
Nice.
I'm a big music fan. But I don't do music on bikes. I just like to listen to the engine. I don't know why that is.
No, that's good.
What was the other part of the question?
No, that's it. You've made your own music with the missus in New Zealand. Sounds, leave it there, props. Do you know what? I think you might be one of a very few handful of guests who've said they would take the missus as well. So you're going to get brownie points for that.
Well, she never watches stuff on it. I'm going to have to make her watch this now, so I do get brownie points on that.
I love that. She never watches all the stuff. More importantly, does she watch your stuff though, Andy? That's the main thing.
No, that's exactly it. And she's on some of it. She's on quite a bit of it. In fact, I wish she'd start her own channel. One of the comments I get a lot is, when's she going to start her own channel? Wouldn't that be fantastic? I could just ride then and not have to have a flipping camera. And I could stop with the silly catchphrases.
This has been amazing. I've loved it. I've absolutely loved it. Sadly, though, Ewan, as ever, we've got to come to the end on it. And that's about it for this week's full chat powered by Bikeshaw. As UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance and so much more.
I think you'll all agree. Thank you so much to our special guest. It's been brilliant today. It is, of course, the one and only Andy Randall, a.k.a. the Missenden Flyer. It's been great, Andy. Thanks.
Thank you very much for having me, gents. Lovely to meet you.
Yep, it's been lovely. And that hint of professionalism crept in when you're asking us questions. That threw us for a second, though, because no one's ever done that. So thank you very much. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
And as ever, from props and myself, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.